Okay, like I said, we are continuing in lesson 35. The focus is essentially on the book of Ezra, with sort of backups by Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and then there's a sort of a specific part in Nehemiah that has to do with what this book calls the third return. All right, so we got down through and discussed, as did Mickey, the vast majority of return number one and Esther, and then we started and we're probably in the midst of discussing return number two, but of course I have a tendency to just jump all over the place, so it's kind of hard to tell where I am. I did study through the lesson book again and look through some of the texts, and even though they have a return number three on here, I don't perceive that the third episode was actually a return. It was just Nehemiah and his associates coming down from Susa. What was the other name for Susa? It was anyway.
Ecbatana.
Huh? Ecbatana was the capital of the Medes, and it was taken over by Cyrus to form the Medo-Persian Empire, and be nice because it's the one that's in Esther that says they're all in the palace of such and such. Now I can't find it. I guess the best thing would be to go to Esther. Shushan.
Is that what I said before?
It might have been, but I didn't understand it. It's interesting to note when we got over to when we lived over in Egypt.
That's actually in the heading on page 145. Is that good? Sorry.
It isn't.
Go ahead.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh yeah, I didn't look there. Anyway, when we went over and we lived in Egypt, our oldest daughter, of course, was with us, and her name is Susan, but they couldn't pronounce Susan, so they always pronounced her name Sausan, because that's the closest they could get. Kind of like when they were trying to cross the Jordan River, and what was it? Shibboleth and Sibboleth, yeah. They were supposed to say Shibboleth, and if they said Sibboleth because they couldn't pronounce Shibboleth, then they ended up losing important portions of their life, like all of it. So, yeah. All right. So let's see. How much do I want to move this one back to Nehemiah so that we have him available for us? Once again, I just wanted us to, I can never find the beginning. Just remember where we are. Remember, we're here, of course, in the Western Hemisphere, and the area that we're going to, is halfway around the globe, all the way over here in the Mediterranean area, and it is essentially literally halfway around the world. I mean, if I look over the top of the globe, I can see that Israel's right about here, California's right about here, so we're actually sort of maybe halfway around the globe, and maybe Hawaii, but it's still close enough for government work. And if we of course zoom in on this area right here, well, we of course have areas that I've labeled Assyria, Babylon, and of course, because the last time I really updated this thing was when we were studying that, but we're looking at the Medo-Persian Empire now, which stretches from the Indus River over here in India somewhere, all the way over to the Aegean Sea, and then all the way down to, and including in many instances, the land of Egypt. So we have an extremely large kingdom here that encompasses how many square miles? 2 million square miles. The United States encompasses 3 million square miles. So it's only, it's two-thirds the size of the United States. I believe that 3 million square miles in the United States is just the continental United States, right? Or does it include Alaska, which adds quite a bit to it? I don't think they said. I think they just used the two numbers in the book. But, yeah. And all it says the 48 contiguous states of the United States total a little more than 3 million square miles. So we add in Alaska and the small portion of Hawaii, we get even more than that. So Anyway, but that kingdom is about two-thirds the size of the United States, so it's a pretty good size, especially for the fact that, given the fact that there were not rapid modes of transportation, there are not rapid methodologies of communication and such like as that. one of the things that I read in in my secular history book about that was that I think the reason that the some of the people in the Northern Kingdom knew that the armies of Assyria were coming down and taking away other cities is that they lost their communication mirrors or whatever between posts, and so apparently they would communicate much like we did here in more primitive days, when they would use lights and mirrors and things like that to do signaling. And this book mentions that there was some report that was extra-biblical indicating that they had lost communication with some outpost or something, and by that they realized that the Assyrian army was getting closer. So that was kind of interesting. I mentioned last time that for some reason I had written down that Cyrus reigned from 559 B.C. to 528 B.C., and that's because that I decided to write two fives instead of a five and a three. So Cyrus reigned from 539 B.C. to 528 B.C., and then the return of the Jews happened in 538 B.C., which is just, the next year after that. And, of course, the text of the Bible shows or says that that's that it was in the first year of the reign of Cyrus that the people received permission to leave. Now, I had mentioned that people were upset with one of the kings because he'd taken and placed all of the gods of the other people in one particular city. It wasn't Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire, but rather it was Nabonidus. Now, who was Nabonidus? It's not one that we see in the Bible. We see rather his son, who was the last king of the Babylonian Empire, Belshazzar, right? so you remember that it was Belshazzar that was partying hardy with his buddies when the finger of God wrote upon the wall, right? And a lot of people will say, well, Belshazzar wasn't king. His daddy, Nabonidus, was king. Well, his daddy, Nabonidus, spent a lot of his time running around being an archaeologist kind of guy. And he was down here in this area trying to restore some ancient city. It's interesting to note that we consider these people ancient, but they were going down excavating ancient cities. So that would mean they're more even ancienter than ours. But anyway, so Nabonidus sort of left Belshazzar in charge of the Assyrian Empire. So essentially Belshazzar was king. But Nabonidus was actually the formal king at that time. But anyway, Nabonidus was the one that decided to gather all these gods up of the other peoples and put them together. Let me just read from there. He starts saying, the propaganda of Cyrus the Great, that was Cyrus that we're concerned about, who vanquished Babylon in 539 B.C., is of interest for the view it expresses about Nabonidus. Cyrus accuses Nabonidus of having neglected Marduk, the great universal god. Furthermore, Nabonidus, in the course of Cyrus's invasion, had offended the pantheon, in other words, all the other gods, by exiling the various gods to Babylon. And then parenthetically, he says, from Nabonidus's viewpoint, the step had been taken to save the gods from falling into the hands of the enemy and to keep the gods on Nabonidus's side. Marduk, therefore, this is according to Cyrus, Marduk, therefore, summoned Cyrus to restore the gods to their rightful shrines. Aside from the way this explains Cyrus's restoration of Yahwehism on Zion, it shows the monotheistic undercurrent of the times. Marduk is identified with the supreme deity that governs world history. So that's this essentially, as far as I'm concerned, even though he might consider himself a Christian, I would call him an unbeliever. at least as far as the inspiration of the Bible goes. But anyway, it's interesting to note that it is Cyrus's desire to redistribute the gods that had been placed in one. Did it mention what town it was? To Babylon, right? And so the Nabonidus had taken all of these foreign gods, all of these various gods of the pantheon, and he'd taken their statues, or whatever we want to call them, idols is what we would call them, and put them in Babylon for safekeeping. And also, as it said, so that the gods would be on Nabonidus' side. And this apparently upset the folks around there whose gods these were. And so they much didn't like Nabonidus, and apparently that's one of the reasons why when the Persian army marched into Babylon to take over, there wasn't really anybody there to defend him. So they were sort of greeted more as liberators than they were as invaders. Anyway, so because of this, what Nabonidus had done in locating all of the idol gods in the city of Babylon, Cyrus, who was much more liberal thinking, I guess, than Nabonidus, or at least he felt that Marduk was his one and only god, and that was the only one that he really needed to be concerned about, and the only one he needed to please, and he wanted to make the other gods feel better by allowing them to go back to their own countries. So that's why when we see the Bible talking about, and we discussed this last time, we see the Bible talking about the fact that the Israelites were allowed to go back home. We need to realize that everybody was allowed to go back home. But the fact that everybody was allowed to go home is not important to the Bible story. What's important to the Bible story is that the Israelites were permitted to do that. They, of course, didn't have any, supposedly, and I think we talked about this also, they didn't have any gods to take back with them. In other words, they had nobody that represented Jehovah God. They might have had, you know, some calves and goats or whatever they made idol things out of. But they weren't really their gods. And there was no real God that represented Jehovah God. Now, you'll remember, what did Aaron say when the golden calves magically popped out of the fire back when the people wanted him to make them gods?
Well, he said that the people,
Did he not say, and I'd have to look this up, but I'm pretty sure this was...
He said he just threw it into the fire and it just came out.
Out they came. And then he said, these are your gods that brought you out of Egypt. He didn't say, this is Jehovah who brought you out of Egypt. He said, these are your gods. And, what's his name? Jeroboam did essentially the same thing. He didn't make calves and say, this is Jehovah. He made calves and said, essentially, these are your gods. I don't think anybody made any god, idol rather, I should say, that they said represented Jehovah God. I don't remember anything about that in the Bible anywhere. So they are all supposed to take the place of or be kind of like, or, you know, it's kind of like the progressive commercial that says, well, I'm kind of like his teacher and I'm kind of like the valet and things like that. It wasn't really. Randy?
I was just going to say, we had to wait for the Catholics to do that.
Oh. Yeah, there are certain... But it's interesting to note that the first time that I went to Salt Lake City on business, that one of the software guys that I was working with there said, hey, you want me to take you on a tour of Temple Square? And I said, sure, I'd like to see what's going on, you know, because the thing is that, and this is getting way off track, but anyway, the thing is that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Lord's Church have some similar history, in that you'll remember back when Alexander Campbell was about in the 1840s, 1830s, going around preaching in the what we would call the Eastern United States, but at that time they called the Far West. He was going around, and one of the people that went around with him preaching the gospel was who? Anybody know? Huh? A famous person in the LDS Church, Sidney Rigdon. He was the first, as it were.
He was responsible for taking a lot of that doctrine over to him.
It is supposed that of the two, Sidney Rigdon and little Joey Smith, that Sidney Rigdon came up with the doctrine and Joseph Smith sold it. He was the used car salesman. And it is supposed then that Sidney Rigdon was the one that came up with the doctrine. Well, he had been thoroughly convinced, at least up until the time that he met Joseph, that what he was preaching was the truth. He and Alexander Campbell went around for a number of years preaching what we would call gospel meetings, you know, around and preaching to people. So when Sidney Rigdon defected over toward Joseph Smith, and then all of a sudden out pops the Mormon Church, the write-up that Alexander Campbell did on Sidney Rigdon in the Millennial Harbinger would be enough to make your hair stand up. I mean, he did not have a... He called Sidney Rigdon everything but a nice guy. So, you know, in polite, relatively polite terms. But still, it's interesting to note that their start is much like the start of the Lord's Church to a certain amount, in that it took a bunch of doctrine from the Bible and put it in and then perverted it. But I was going to talk about my tour of Temple Square. And so Harold took me all around and showed me this and that and the other thing, and we went through this one building that was a multi-story, like, historical building or something like that. And as we went in there, and he wanted me to take me in to show, there was like a 20 or 30 minute movie that they showed the history and all that sort of stuff. As a matter of fact, there's some Mormon doctrine and the stuff we're studying tonight. I'll bring that up also. Anyway, went in and saw the movie, and as I'm walking through this building, you know, here's a statue of Moroni. No, here's 14 statues of Moroni. Here's a statue of Joseph Smith. No, here's 5 statues of Joseph Smith. Here's a statue of Brigham Young. No, they're all on the balcony. There's about 14 statues of Brigham Young up there. And so he made pains to point out to me that these were not idols, that these were just donated by people who, you know, made them themselves. I thought,
idolized
them, right? So they've got all these statues of the angel Moroni and Joseph Smith and Brigham Young in this building, but they're not idols. So it's important to keep clear. So they're just statues. So I thought, well, that's a little strange. Okay, David. Yeah. Right. And so that's supposed to model after the what do they call it? The pool that the priests were supposed to wash themselves in the temple. So that was a big bowl, and it was mounted on the back of 12 oxen. So I think that's because they have, you'll remember, if you remember your Mormon doctrine, that they have two priesthoods set up. They have the Melchizedekian priesthood and the Levitical priesthood, as I recall. And one part of the priesthood is supposed to do this, and another part of the priesthood. It's much like the difference between the Levites and the priests. Okay, the priests were of Aaronic descent, whereas the Levites were just generally of the tribe of Levi. So all of the people who are of Aaronic descent certainly are of the tribe of Levi, but they're called, the people of Aaron were called priests, whereas the people that were just plain old Levites, they were just called Levites. anyway, so it's interesting to note how many religions have taken and abused the things that are in the Bible because of man's wishes to do things. In other words, it's man's doctrine. You know, we've got these books that tell us, you know, we need to do this and we need to do that, and all these books, but they're books other than the Bible. Randy?
Well,
The only reason I brought up Catholicism is because there's so many statues of Jesus that they'll tell you they're not gods, but they kneel before them and pray to them. So what is that? If that's not.
And I think one of the things is that when we look back at the Ten Commandments, or not the Ten Commandments, but all of the commandments that were given from the mountain, which were actually rather numerous, it mentions that we are not to make idols of anything, including God. And the Jews in secular history, it doesn't point it out particularly in the Bible, but you look at ancient archaeology and things like that, and you see they never made any carvings of animals, of people, of things like the only carvings and things that they made, and if you look in the temple and even in the tabernacle, the only thing they did was flowers and tulips and
pomegranates
and things like that. Those really stained, though. Anyway, but so, you know, they did all that, but they did not make any idols, I-D-O-L-S. They didn't carve any. They didn't sew any. They didn't, you know, knit any. Nothing like that. It was all just flowers and stuff like that. So the Bible was pretty clear about that they're not supposed to do that. We don't make images of creatures or men. That's just part of the law. Yes. Oh, good. I like unrelated comments.
Yes, this is what this class is all about. So, I did a little looking things up, and the square miles of the United States is about 3.8 million, including Alaska.
Oh, okay.
So, the 48 contiguous states is about 3.1 million, but if you do a little research on the Medo-Persian Empire, it looks like that at its height, it was about 3 million square miles. So
okay.
It's roughly the size as the contiguous U.S. In the grand scheme of things, Judah, after it was split from Israel, is only marginally bigger than Delaware.
That's pretty small. Yeah. Yeah. Marginally bigger than Delaware. So, yeah, okay. So, yes, as a matter of fact, because the Medo-Persian Empire sometimes expanded into and sometimes did not expand into Egypt, there were some things there, but it was Cambyses who was the second, I think. It was Cyrus, and then his son was Cambyses. That's the one that they called Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes in the first letter that was written. That Cambyses, he came down and he finished the conquering of Egypt and he became a pharaoh. And that was essentially the end of the Egyptian pharaonic reign. And so Cambyses became Pharaoh Cambyses or whatever they called him down in Egypt. And that was an interesting thing to note. Another thing on the question sheet that no doubt all of you have for question for lesson 35 that I emailed out to everybody that I had one for and put 20 copies on the back table about, is that the first question that we have on here, it says, the permission granted by Cyrus to be able to return home included all the tribes of whom? Pardon?
All the tribes of Israel.
All the tribes of Israel. In other words, he didn't restrict it to just the tribes of Judah. He didn't say, well, all you Judean people, you can go home, and all you other people can't. Who do we see in the early baby life of Jesus in the temple that's from a tribe that we can't identify with Judah or Benjamin? What's her name? The old lady? And the Anna was from the tribe of Asher. They were of the 10 tribes in the north. And so we occasionally see in the New Testament people that were from tribes that were not from Benjamin or Judah. And so some people did come back, apparently, that were part of that taking away by the Babylonians, where Why is there a hand in the middle of my hand?
Yeah,
you can't have that. part of the Babylonians, that some of them had, by the time they got to leave, their families had been there for 200 years. Long time. So, but some of them came back. David?
Some of them came back. I was just a question. Would you say the more faithful ones came back?
Well, it would seem that to me, but, you know, that's a judgment call I guess I shouldn't be prepared to make. You know, it could be the people that were simply just upset with their government there. I mean, you know, how bad is the government in California going to get before we all leave, or something like that? you know.
But again, the Ottomans desired to stay.
They did. And yet we see that they helped them. They helped the ones that wanted to go. So they weren't. There was no apparent anyway animosity between them. It was like, well, I want to go live in Israel, or Judah, or whatever they called it at that time. And, you know, I'm going to stay here where my family's been for the last 200 years. And I think we discussed this last time, that one of the reasons that that Hitler didn't like the Jews is he felt that they were unfairly more prosperous than the Aryan race. You know, so they got out and got around, and they made, you know, they did well for themselves. If we look in the book of Esther, we see that those people were integrated into Babylonian society at that time. Esther is Persian. They were, well, of course, it was all, you know, all Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, but by that time, yes, Persian. And so they were all integrated into Persian society. We don't see that they were treated like the pharaohs treated them, like slaves. We see that there were Jews in these cities and Jews in these. There were Jews in all the satrapies that was mentioned. I think there was mentioned 120 or 127 different satrapies, which were like states or counties or whatever you want to call it. And they each had a ruler over them. And so when things got tough for the Jews in the time of Esther, we see that when it talks about them, it doesn't talk about them as being slaves. It says, well, they lived here, and those lived there. So they were all divided around. And so some of them decided to go. And some of them, many of them, most of them, decided to stay. Jenny?
Well, I'm not sure necessarily that we can say that only the most faithful went back, because as far as I know, there's no indication that, for example, Nehemiah came back to stay. As far as I know, he went back to be
He stayed for 12 years and then went back and then requested that he be brought back again. But yes, he apparently had a job in the capital, whatever it was. I forget what the capital of Medo-Persia Empire was. It wasn't Ecbatana. It was something else. Well, maybe we can say it was Susa, because that's where the Esther was and things like that. So perhaps that's where the capital was. But it looks like that Nehemiah perhaps felt like he was sort of split between two countries. Juan?
I mean, you could see that the Jews actually maybe not had rank, but when Haman was all upset with Mordecai, if the Jews had meant nothing, he would have been able to just have him killed.
Right.
Like, straight and foremost, there wouldn't have been no plot or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he had to go out of his way to make it, like, legit, so that he so it wasn't just that they could do whatever. So the Jews had some kind of staying power.
Sure, yeah, the Jews were, I think they were sort of essentially treated as equals at that time. It was, yet when we get to the New Testament times and we look at the way that the Romans treated the people whom they occupied, they treated the people as though they were essentially cattle, expendable people. I don't think that Pilate, when he washed his hands of Jesus, felt any qualms about the fact that somebody was going to die. As far as he was concerned, that was a Jew. It was beneath him to even consider that Jews were would even be considered something similar to humans. They were very prejudiced against the people that they occupied. Now, there were obviously a number of exceptions to that. We see the Acts chapter 10, where Cornelius was obviously a Roman centurion, and he had a great amount of love for the people with whom he was, over whom he was stationed. They were under his control. But it says that he built us our synagogue, and it indicated that he was a believer, though it didn't indicate that he was a believer in God. He prayed to God, but it didn't indicate that he was a Jew. In other words, it didn't appear that he was a proselyte. And so we see that a couple of times in the New Testament. David?
I think about his being in captivity and then Cyrus there as well. You can go back, but then the building stopped and going back stopped. The temple stopped. They had problems with the wall. It's not like you can just go back and walk in and get things
done. Take over, yeah.
It's kind of like you have to fight in a sense to get to where you need to go.
Yeah.
It was a struggle.
Yeah. Well, it was much like when they originally came into the land of Canaan, except at that time, at least when they took over and booted the other people out, there were houses and fields and things already there. When they came back this time, though there were people living there, it was not nearly as populated, I don't think. That's not my impression anyway. It was sort of like the fields had lain fallow for lo these many years. And there just weren't enough people to take care of them. So I think there's a lot of parallels here. But yeah, I think so many of the people did not want to go back, and they stayed. And then we see that they spread out. This guy here mentions the diaspora, in other words, the Jews that spread out. We see that the Jews spread out all over the populated world at that time, and. So, and they had to come from that area. Another tidbit of Mormon doctrine that has to do with this. The Mormons always talk about the 10 lost tribes of Israel, right? And what do they say that happened to the 10 lost tribes of Israel, or at least a portion of them?
They got in the giant football and they came here.
Okay, and so That's the interesting thing. And I guess they landed in South America because they had hieroglyphics and spoke with the Aztecs and things like that. So, but and so those of you that don't know about the giant football, it's a very interesting thing to read. The Book of Mormon does not call it the giant football. But
the commentators
call it that. Yes. But the thing is that you'll remember we look at the ark that Noah was commanded to build, and we see how it was supposed to be built and all. And when you look at it and you draw it up, it looks like a boat, a barge, really. It doesn't look like a naval vessel of any kind.
Aerodynamic.
Yeah, no, it's not aerodynamic, but it floats on the water. Well, when you go and look in the Book of Mormon and look at the ark that Nephi, I think it was. Anyway, was supposed to build, the Nephites were supposed to build, and these were the people that were part of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. They were supposed to build. After you finish looking at the way it's described and everything, it's round and pointed on the ends. It looks like what we would picture as a football. And it was supposed to have an air hole in the top so that they could, make their cooking fires and the smoke would go out and they get air and things like that. Well, they set out to sea, and what happens? But the football rolls so that the hole is now in the water. They're taking on water. So they have to plug up that hole and drill another hole. So I'm not sure how they managed to stabilize the ship for sure. But I think they had as the ship would roll as they were going from the Mediterranean somewhere over to the New World, they had to rotate and plug this hole several times.
They didn't really have to plug the hole because it never really happened.
Well, that's true. Okay. Yes, it's true. It never really happened. So we didn't have to worry about whether they had a nice cork plug to put in there.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
Just a fairy tale.
It is. Yeah, they should have thought about it a little more before they wrote that down. So it's been an event of great humor to people throughout the ages about this football that the Nephites came across the seas in. Now that I think about it, I'm trying to figure out how in the world they got out of the Mediterranean. You know, it's not, huh? Yeah. Yeah, Paul didn't make it very well. So, but anyway, so.
It's just a, with a Hail Mary.
Okay, great pass. Okay, fine. Anyway, I have a book, and Mickey probably still has many copies of it, or several copies of it, because we ended up with two boxes of it. A very interesting book, if you're interested, which has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about here as far as this study, called Mormonism Against Itself. And you just go through page after page after page after what they've said and then what they did, what they said and what they did, and how it doesn't match up. That's why it's so important to make sure that what we say is what we do and that what we say is what the Bible says. Because you don't want people to, you know, take your own book and point it at you and say, look, can't you even do this? I mean, this is what your book says to do. So that's what a lot of people who are unbelievers in God will point out. It says, well, you're all just a bunch of hypocrites. Well, it's true that you might say that there are more hypocrites in the church than any place else, because they're at least the people that are trying to do something that's right. The people that are out are not hypocrites, because they'll tell you they go out and fool around and drink and you know, run their cars, you know, over kitty cats and things like that. You know, it's just, you know, so just want to make sure that we try to keep that kind of activity out of our lives. Okay. So, in the and we talked about this last week, of course, in the returns. So, we looked at some of the statistics from return number one. I got it here somewhere. I put it in red, and oh, there it is. So when they were permitted to go free in Cyrus's the first year of Cyrus's reign, if you total up all the numbers in there, of course, 49,897 people, more or less, went back to Israel. Took 4 months to do that. Last week I counted wrong. You know, January, February, March, April. That's all of April, and they got there in May, what we would consider May. So it took them 4 months to get there. At least it took Nehemiah that long to get there earlier on, or later on, I should say, or Ezra. And so these folks, 42,360 of the people, and they had 7,337 servants and 200 singers. So, as the book says, almost 50,000 people. In the first return to Israel. And then, I guess where he says the three returns, you know, they're talking about Nehemiah returns to build the walls. He didn't bring a bunch of folks with him. He returned or came to Jerusalem. And so that's what they're calling the third return. But so that first one we talked about, where about 50,000 people, Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar, what's his name? No. Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar. I got it right. They brought those folks along. Where was that? There it is. The next one, Ezra returns with the priests, mostly priests. It's a limited number of people, and there are people there that are not priests. As a matter of fact, he had to go looking for some of the priests. And so we look at then return number two, which happened essentially after the book of Esther. And we see at that time that the Bible counts the males that came back. But you'll remember here in this area that it also says that there were little ones with them. So we realize that there are wives and children with them also. So we see that about 2,000 males came along. A lot of them were priests and Levites. And so they brought their families along. So we might say that 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 additional people. So, but we've still only got 53,000 people that have come back. When we look at that, we realize that's less than half the size of the city of Lancaster. That's not a whole lot of people to occupy an area that, Jenny, did you say was the size of Delaware? About? So, and then, of course, return number three is that Nehemiah asked permission to return and build the walls. So the first folks, that's one thing, point I was going to make, is that if we look and say, well, these were the most faithful people, what did they do in the first time? How many years did they wait after they laid the foundation of the temple to finish building the temple? To start finishing building the temple. They waited for 16 years, right? And we see that by counting the kings and things like that. So these supposedly faithful folk decided that they'd wait 16 years to finish building the temple while they did what? Built their own houses. And then when we come back to what is called return number three here, Nehemiah comes down, and it's 90 years after Cyrus had given permission to go home. And when Nehemiah comes down, what does he find? The walls are all broken down, right? Everything's in ruins and ashes or whatever. Even, as a matter of fact, apparently things were burned so badly by the invaders that the rocks were burned. My understanding is that if you get a rock hot enough, it won't really hold its solidity anymore. In other words, if you get it hot enough and then you let it cool down, hit it with a hammer, it'll just shatter. They mentioned that even the stones were burned, so that may have been in that condition. It weakens the stones, just as heating metals and doing certain things with them will either strengthen them or weaken them, depending on what you do with them. So he came down, and now, as it says here, this was 90 years after they had gotten permission to go home. They still hadn't built the wall. And yet, when they got down to it then, well, when they got down to it back 90 years ago, how long after that 16-year period did it take them to finish the temple? 4 years. And now they're going to go build a wall 90-ish years later, or 80 years later, 70 years later. And how long does it take them to finish building the wall? 52 days, right? I think that's on one of these slides here somewhere. Right there. And why did it take them 52 days? Only 52 days. Because they had a mind to work. Okay. But Nehemiah had to come down and poke him with a cattle prod in order to get him to do this. And then there were all sorts of other things that were going on. Also, they had married foreign women, what they weren't supposed to do. Even after the walls were put up, they were selling and trading on the Sabbath. They were letting foreigners into the city on the Sabbath day. There was all sorts of things that they were doing. And so they had to be read the riot act several times in order for them to kind of straighten up and fly right. Okay. I've just sort of wandered all over the place, but I think that what we probably will want to do is, if you haven't gotten the questions for chapters or lessons 35 and 36, please do that. I've got the questions for lesson 36 if you didn't get them up here. Now, those of you that are on my emailing list, you got not only the questions, you got what? The answers. If you get these, you're not getting any of the answers. You got to do it all yourself. So, to your benefit to, be on my email list.